Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 124, with first-time guest and real-world contributor Scott Kelly. Also, host of the Fear of God podcast, friend of the show, Reed Lackey. So listen up, because this is another good one. On this episode, we talk A Monster Calls and A Better Truth. But, Scott, I'm really glad you are on the podcast. Have you done any podcasting?
And, you know, I was just talking with Reed about that. I did one episode with Aaron on Feel and Film about The Conjuring 2.
Nice.
And I did one other episode with a friend of mine, local friend of mine, who at one time had a podcast. But that podcast episode actually never got published because he stopped doing it. So, yeah, I've officially done one. Well, not counting the other one because it never really happened in the records of the internet.
Well, so that's the old adage, you know, older than time, really. If you record a podcast in a forest and no one's around to publish it, did it ever happen? So apparently we know your answer, pessimist.
Yeah.
My beautiful segues, which I love and I'm so good at because I point them out, which makes them amazing, is
it's true.
I just talked about the forest, and A Monster Calls has a tree as a main character. So you can see how we've already connected those dots. So I mean, boom, you're welcome for being an amazing host.
Masterfully segued.
Yep.
Yes. Yep. Masterfully segued.
So I went to see A Monster Calls. And I think I posted on Facebook, I said, putting on my crying pants, because I think I literally saw this film probably almost a full week to 2 weeks after almost everyone I know who was excited about this film, including both of you guys. You know, I saw the reactions from both you guys on social media, plenty of other people from the Real World Theology, greater, you know, conversation world. And I was like, oh my gosh, I got to see this. And ever since becoming a dad, this is well documented, probably on air and off, ever since I become a dad, where I was semi-prone to crying on occasion before, you know, like man tear, single man tear. Now I cry all the time. Everything makes me emotional. And
It'll do it.
Everything is more real to me.
You know, I was just having that conversation with my wife. I finished a rewatch of Stranger Things, mm-hmm. and the final episode with, you know, well, I won't spoil anything. I almost did. But there's a lot of really emotional stuff that deals with kids. Mm-hmm. And I had tears coming down my face. I was like, well, this is new. This didn't happen the first time. You know, yeah. holding my three-month-old in my arms, you know, I was like, oh, maybe that's why. Yeah.
Did you do one of those Terminator things? And you're like, why am I leaking kind of thing? You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
You just didn't understand.
Just give it a few more years, and then you'll be watching every movie and go, ugh, stupid kids. I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding. My son's amazing. Your children will both be amazing as well.
Well, so it brings me to a fundamental question that I don't think we've actually ever answered, because it's something that's kind of been an undercurrent of lots of grief or sad films that we've reviewed through the years. And, you know, I know I've made offhand comments, and many guests have kind of made like little kind of side comments about crying or weepiness or sadness in a film. And I don't think we've ever addressed the fact that to cry or not to cry, which is manlier, you know? Like, I want to, like, when someone comes up to you and tells you, because I feel like obviously we're all admitting to being weepy, especially since becoming fathers, and probably sure. for various other reasons. So it's not like we're bringing a new necessarily idea to the table, because it's kind of a yes or no. But when someone comes up to you and tells you that they try not to cry or they don't think it's very manly to cry, should these conversations happen, like, what's your kind of response when you engage that person?
You know, it's interesting because I wasn't entirely prepared to talk about this, but I think that in general, I don't see a lot of benefit in stifling emotional reactions to anything. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, maturity sort of tempers unkempt emotions to where your emotions are just running away from you. I definitely think that maturity, and we should try to not let our emotions control us. But at the same time, like, if you feel expressive about something, I don't necessarily see that as a particularly feminine quality, but I know a lot of people do. There's a tendency when a boy, especially like a young boy, when they cry, you know, I've seen some dads tell the kid to man up, or hey, we don't cry around here. And I always have just a completely opposite reaction, because I grew up in a household where my father was on the sensitive side, so he would tear up a little bit occasionally, and I definitely am that way. And then, you know, my son, when he gets emotional, I try my best not to stifle necessarily his crying, unless I think he's being dramatic, in which case I'll call him out for it. But if it's something that I think is genuinely based in, hey, you're, you know, sad about this, it's fine. Try to hug him, try to comfort him. And I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing, even though it can sort of be stigmatized as a specifically non-masculine thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to agree with Reed on that. One of my good friends, we always kind of joke with each other that we both get, you know, pretty emotional depending on, you know, the context of, you know, what's going on in the movie. And his wife is just stone cold. Like she doesn't cry with anything. So, you know, we always poke fun at that, but, yeah, it's, I mean, we've already established that, you know, becoming a parent, and I guess, especially, you know, movies with children, it does change you when you become a parent. And I think when I was looking online at all the reviews, and, you know, people were saying, oh, it was, you know, too emotional. It was contrived emotion, you know, and all this. I was like, I don't know about that. And I was thinking, you know, it's like, maybe the line is, do you have a kid or don't you? Or have you lost someone in your life, like in your immediate family, or haven't you? You know, it's, I think there's something there that their comments kind of leave out in the open, you know. I don't know.
That's what we call, as of a couple podcasts ago, the arrival test. So,
oh, gosh. That movie messed me up at the end, but we're not talking about that right now.
Well, yeah, but we kind of are, though, right? So
I guess so.
I mean, like, what we've noticed over and over and over again, without being an absolute, is people who do have kids, once you get to the end of arrival, the weepiness happens for the kid having people, and the, oh, that's pretty cool, happens for like the non-kid having people. And I have to think, on some level, you know, this applies to almost all the grief films that we've seen. Actually, Gene wrote a really good kind of reflection on the movies of 2016 over at Real World Theology, and talked about
I read that.
And that was a good piece.
And talked about how kids, you know, there's this undercurrent of like having kids or seeing through the eyes of children, kind of seeing something that we've seen before, but it kind of adds a little twist to it and kind of hooks you, because it, like I said, it just shifts your perspective slightly. And, you know, man, this is Manchester by the Sea, because like the grief he feels, like I feel on a different level at being a dad than I would have just been like, oh, that's really terrible. But it's like, I can't imagine. Like, I'm broken thinking of what that would do. And so I have to think that carries into A Monster Calls on some level. You know, people being like, I think it's just manipulative if maybe you don't have a kid, so you can't imagine your child having to bear that burden alone. Or, you know, if you do have a child, you're like, I would swoop in immediately, and it makes me weepy just thinking about my child being in that much pain. So I think, you know, we're not talking about it, but I think we are kind of talking about it. And
you know, well, and, oh, sorry. We all like dive yeah. in. I would like to mention one thing, because you used a word that I was thinking of earlier, and I think it actually ties pretty closely into this film, because that is a common phrase among film buffs, and talk about how whether or not a film is manipulative to you, or whether or not the emotional reaction that you're having has been, you know, contrived based on, hey, this scenario really would not bring you to tears, but the music is swelling and mm-hmm. the, you know, the performances are really drawing it out of you. And I don't know, I've never entirely felt that I was being cheaply manipulated by something. If I didn't have an emotional response to it, I usually just say that didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. Like it didn't, you know, like it's not necessarily a negative knock on the film. I'll just usually say I did not prefer that, but it has always sort of put a question mark in my brain when somebody's like, that was manipulative to try to get you emotionally verklempt because you were so caught up with everything that's happening in the scene. And I'm like, well, that's a story. Like, so are you mm-hmm. saying that the times that you got emotional at something else that actually worked for you, that wasn't also manipulative? I mean, that's still because, you know, the filmmaker was telling a story and utilizing, you know, the script and visuals and music and all of these other things to elicit those same reactions to you. So to a degree, there is some kind of manipulation. And I remember thinking as I was watching specifically A Monster Calls about sort of the pieces of information that the monster gives to Connor at different times, and how that leads Connor down certain paths or comments on a particular circumstance he's dealing with at the moment. And it is interesting, the reason I bring it up and I'll stop here, is that, you know, you could say that the monster was throughout this story manipulating Connor, but in a way that was very productive, and in a way that I obviously for reasons that I'm sure we'll get into, that was ultimately very helpful. But he's unquestionably sort of manipulating the situation, manipulating his perspective by withholding information or giving out information. So if the film itself is doing that, I don't necessarily think that that's a negative criticism. Am I making any sense, or am I just rambling in one of my readings?
Oh, no. I think that makes sense. I wanted to add something to that, I guess, which may lead us into discussion about the thematic stuff about Monster Calls. But I think there's the difference, you know, we're talking about, you know, contrived emotion or is too emotional. I think you can boil that down to just, you know, having a good cry or a bad cry. And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, a good cry, you know, that to me, stories that give me that good cry, you know, they stories that have, you know, the possibility of, you know, redemption or healing or, you know, basically a whole conversion. And depressing movies, which, you know, are the bad cries, those are the ones that just leave you – they're just nihilistic. They just leave you hopeless. They leave you resigned. So with the good cry, you know, the sadness, I think the sadness is just a part of our journey into this newness, I guess, this new person. And, you know, a couple other movies that have really – are along those lines. I think Inside Out is a good example. Mm-hmm. And Finding Neverland, that one was really good as well. So I don't know. Does that make sense to you guys? Maybe they're just the difference between a good cry and a bad cry, and, you know, being contrived or too emotional.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah. I was going to say, when I was trying to think right then, when I was trying to think of a bad cry, I was jumping to a movie like Seven or something like that, when at the end you'd want to cry because you're so unhappy with how it ends. But I was like, well, I didn't really cry then. So I tried to think of the last time I had a really bad cry. And I remembered that just recently I was talking to my wife about crying, because we've kind of had this game ever since crying has been a topic since basically we've seen Arrival and all the Oscar movies have come out since. She's like, did you cry? Because we've had to see a lot of them separate. I'm like, did you cry? You know, and like, it'll be interesting to see which one she cries at, which one I don't cry. And I said, I was recounting her a story from my childhood when I was with my dad and we were watching one of the WCW wrestling pay-per-views, and me and my brother, I mean,
oh boy,
we couldn't have been, oh gosh, I want to say that I was probably like 9 or 10 maybe. So my brother was, you know, 2 or 3 years younger than me. And we're watching, we're just having a great time. And we're watching Ricky the Dragon Steamboat fight Ric Flair. And
oh yeah.
And it's just this great match. And we're on the edge of our seat. And we were just the biggest Ricky the Dragon Steamboat fans. But when Flair won that match, me and my brother just, we just broke down. It was just, our dreams had been crushed. It was what I would consider a bad cry.
Yeah.
And my dad reminded us, very callously that it's just wrestling and it's not even real. So, you know, points for him.
Oh man.
Mikey, that
points
story,
away from him. I'm just kidding.
That story is very familiar to me because I think the first time I cried at a movie, and I don't know what age I was, but I remember getting quite emotional at the end of it, was Godzilla versus King Kong. When King Kong beat Godzilla, I knew it was fixed. I was so I was so mad. I was like, there's no way that King Kong could beat Godzilla. Godzilla is my guy. And I was quite upset.
Yeah, who wrote this?
That's right.
Hey, they got another chance to do it right, I think, in like 2 years. So yeah. We'll see.
Well, so I tell all those stories because it was very interesting to have this kind of ongoing, like, are you crying? Did you cry? Because I think for my wife and I, it's very interesting to see kind of what some of our triggers are. Like, there's lots of things that are obviously going to be the same in certain movies. But, you know, I'm like, oh, I saw this and... I just didn't do it, you know, like everyone's saying,
right,
whatever. And it didn't, she's like, well, I got a little weepy at parts, and I'm like, okay. And vice versa. And so it's interesting to see what type of stories, connect with our empathy or our emotions on that level. And then once she finished The Monster Calls, it was very, very interesting to me that she made this observation that I don't think I would have, probably because I am a dude. She said, I wonder if, especially with what you see in A Monster Calls that we'll talk about in just when we get to the stories a little bit later, she said, there's this idea that men, you know, men don't cry. And I have noticed in film that the men who are repressing their emotions almost always have some time when there's like an angry or it manifests itself when it's internalized into rage and anger. And it comes out as this very aggressive, often physical act. And I said, oh yeah, that's probably right. That kind of seems like probably what's happening. Cause usually when I tend to repress a lot of emotions like that, cause I'm trying to be the stalwart, you know, husband figure, like I'll deal with my emotions a little bit later, not right in the situation. And that's when like it wells up in me and I just want to hit something. But if I let myself enter emotion land, I don't feel that rage often, not every time. Sometimes injustice is injustice. And I think there's a righteousness to the anger, but, I think, There's a healthiness to letting ourselves be sad. If Inside Out has taught us anything, it's that sadness has a place.
Absolutely.
So, we've talked about crying, and I appreciate you guys sharing your perspectives. But I have to admit that even though I had my crying pants on, there was not one single tear shed during this film for me.
Oh, things were going so well.
Or by me. And I don't know why. And so I've actually found that I get more emotional thinking back on the film and the things that it dealt with than actually watching the film itself. And so I'm hoping that sometime during this conversation, I'm going to put two and two together. But in the meantime, so like no pressure for you guys, but you guys really need to bring it because, you know, by the end of this episode, I want to be weeping.
We shall make you cry.
You know, lofty goals. But so in A Monster Calls, there's a whole lot of talk about story and the power of story, which anyone who's listened to this story know, or this podcast knows that we're very fond of the power of story. And I want to be able to take the time to address each of the stories within the story. which I know will obviously lead us to the larger, the big picture and thematics of A Monster Calls. And I'm assuming that people have seen it, because obviously we're going to spoil it like we spoil every movie. But the monster shows up, Liam Neeson monster shows up, and he tells Connor, our child, a main character, that he's going to tell him three stories. And these three stories I was completely transfixed by, mainly because of how they were animated, or at least the first two. But just the ambiguity of them. So I know I asked you guys before the show if you'd kind of walk us through these stories, but I didn't actually ask who wanted to walk us through which story. So,
I think maybe I'll take the first, because I'm actually reading the book. I'm about halfway through it, so I'm trying to keep it fresh in my head. So, because I was only able to see the movie once in theaters. I would have liked to support it more, but you know, when 50 people in the whole nation decide to go see a movie, they usually pull from the theaters. Yeah. But I digress. Yeah.
That's something.
So yeah. So the first tale, this is the one about the kingdom with the king, who apparently ruled very well. His wife gave birth to four strong sons, and you know, he rode into battle, fought all these different things, but victory came at a price, and all of his sons were killed. So there only left one heir, and it was his infant grandson. So already we have this king who is, you know, probably in a state of anguish that I can't even fathom myself going through. So, as he and his wife succumb to grief, the king was left with the only child for company, and it was more than he could bear alone. So he decided, all right, I'm going to remarry, it's for the good of my prince and of my kingdom, if not for myself. And he remarried, but it was kind of controversial, because this person he married was very young looking. And everyone's like, you know, what's the deal with this here? So something decided to happen. More controversy, I guess. The king grows ill, and rumor begins to spread that he was being poisoned by this new woman, his wife. So to try to sum up this story here, he died, and his grandson wasn't old enough to take the throne. So this queen takes the throne. So everyone's like, Is this going to be it? Is she going to, you know, take over and it's going to be all bad and everything? And it's like, well, no, her reign was actually a good one. And the prince ends up falling in love. He takes this woman that he fell in love with out on, it was like a prairie or something. I remember the
picturesque.
Yeah, very picturesque. Next to the tree. I wonder who the tree is. And they fall asleep under the tree, and they wake up, and this woman is dead, and he's got blood on his hands, and he wakes up, and he automatically just starts crying. The queen was responsible for this, and he gets everyone in an uproar, and they go and sack the castle, essentially. And but the monster who was the tree follows him, if I remember correctly, and actually ends up saving the queen from her tower as this whole thing is going on. And Connor, when the monster was telling him this story, was almost offended by this. He was just like, why did you do this? She poisoned the king. She killed starts listing off all of her assumed transgressions. And the monster tells him, well, that if there was one thing she was not, it was a murderer. And he tells him that it was actually the prince who killed the woman, and he did it to get everyone in a fervor to kick the queen out so he could take charge. So it was an excellent tale of just the, you know, there's no black and white with this. There's lots of grays to deal with, and mm-hmm. and it was Connor. This was almost, you know, this was a revelation to him. That was probably the one that stuck with me the most, just because you don't really hear a lot of stories like that with you know, fantasy. And you know, I was, you know, at one point in my life, you know, especially at Connor's age, I was the black and white, you know. I was like, oh, this, you know, if this isn't going to be a kissing story, you know, like Princess Bride or something, you know, it'll be a good story of, you know, vanquishing and all that. And no, it's life isn't like that. There's, you know, good comes with bad and bad comes with good. And that's just how it goes. So, I guess I'll throw it to you guys. I summed it up. I've been talking for a bit. So,
well, I think, I think what you're saying, Scott, is that for Connor, He was expecting A New Hope, but he got Rogue One.
I can hear Blaine and Josh just quivering right now in anger.
They're squeeing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, so yeah, because you know he wanted black and white. He got a whole bunch of people who were messy, right? He got not even like anti-heroes. We're not even talking about like the Breaking Bad and Dexters of this world. This is just these aren't people who are like making bad choices. They're just doing human things, which is really crazy. And so, Reed, I'd be interested, like, how do you take the grief that Connor is going through, watching his mom go through cancer treatments that don't seem to be working, but he's trying to keep it, you know, keep his spirits up, trying to deal with his grandma. How do you see this story teaching Connor anything?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I think that it was in reaction to, of course, is his relationship with his grandmother, which is very strained. Mm-hmm. And he sees her, the parallel between the witch in the story and Connor's grandmother are apparent from the moment that he begins telling the story. And of course, Connor even wants, you know, Connor's reaction to the story, he wants the witch to get her comeuppance, because in his head he's equated the grandmother with this witchy character. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you're dealing with relationships with people, we would like to believe that good qualities and bad qualities are homogenous to the individual, meaning that if somebody has an abundance of good qualities, that means everything in them is good. And if somebody has an abundance of bad qualities, that means that they are, you know, wicked and must be defeated and must be destroyed. And I'm not even going to derail us into, you know, our current social and political climate and how that could comment on things. Because
I think that's important, and so I'm not going to stop you if you go there to some degree, because I think it speaks to us as well, you know, as a culture as well.
Sure. Well, and I will say that just in brief that one of the things that reminded me of this story in particular is King David from the Bible, because mm-hmm. people regard him universally as a man after God's own heart, and they remember it, but they dismiss largely the absolutely atrocious thing that he did to Uriah and his wife. And it's one of the things that it makes me think of is, like, if you're looking in this story, it's, you know, in the story that the monster told to Connor, the king, the prince who rises to the throne, rises on the blood of this young lady. Yet the monster is deliberate to point out that he was a good king and that the kingdom thrived under his rule, that he was good at being a king. He just also happened to be a murderer, and that the witch, she would have been a wicked queen and much evil would have been done under her reign. She just did not happen to be guilty of the thing of which she was accused. And it just reminds us that things just don't break down as simply into the black and white boxes that we would love to place them in. So that was the main thing that I wanted to say on it.
That's good. Scott, you had something?
Oh yeah, I was just gonna bring up. Didn't Connor want the monster to like smite the grandmother at one point? Was it around that story in the movie? I forget when he. I don't know if he asked the monster to do it or just brought up the suggestion, but he wanted the monster to take the grandmother out. So
yeah he did.
Yeah, that was that was interesting. I mean, you have the story, and then you have Connor's reactions to these stories, and you know, one told more than the other, I think. Just seeing how someone reacts to a story like that can tell a lot about a character without them even really saying much of anything. So,
well, and that goes back to what Reed was talking about a little bit earlier with, you know, the word manipulation. Like, obviously the monster was trying to manipulate Connor into a certain way of thinking by the way he told the story.
Right.
Because
right.
If he would have told the story with the truth fully known from the beginning, it wouldn't have landed. Like, Connor wouldn't have had the chance to emotionally get to one place or parallel his actions or anything in reality to that story, and then have the kind of the rug pulled out from under him. And I think that's one example of the power of story and storytelling in this.
Right.
And with story one, I think the thing that especially Reed there, you hit on for a little bit was this idea of how the story maybe kind of parallels a lot of things we see currently, because there's this idea about laying the groundwork for Connor, like having his view so held on to, his truth so held on to, that he's willing to believe lies that are a means to the ends. Even if he's presented with truth, he's still wanting those things to be true so he can justify what he wants or the truth that he's trying to live out. And because we see the prince who has to believe that his grandmother-in-law or step-grandmother is evil so he can justify killing his fiance to be the good ruler.
Right.
We see the people who surely have had to have some evidence that maybe the witch or the queen wasn't that evil. They had to believe that she was the one that killed the fiance to accept the prince as the prince.
Right.
Because the prince, like I said, he ruled and he was a great ruler. And so if you have a great ruler, the guy who stands up and is like, well, I think he might have killed his fiance. People are going to be like, yeah, but he's really great, so let's not rock the boat. Which I think, sadly, can be like directly paralleled to a lot of things that have been going on in our country for many, many years, not just like in the current political climate. So,
sure. It's just kind of it's just kind of come to a head in a lot of ways and been laid bare in raw emotional ways. I will make one statement as briefly as I can that is overtly political. So I'm going to ask listeners and hosts apologies for a moment.
Brace yourselves.
The views and political opinions of Reed Lackey do not necessarily represent those of Real World Theology and its affiliates. Not that we have any affiliates.
but one of the things that is always, I will go on record for myself and myself alone that I have never been a fan of our current president, and I have been very critical of many things that happened in the campaign as he was leading up to it. But one of the things that I was consistently very deliberate about doing is I would say, listen, if you support him because of this issue or because of this issue, then by all means support him. Do so proudly. Do so, you know, knowing that you're part of the democratic process. But we must be careful that in the support that we show for the things that matter to us, we do not ignore the things that we would openly reject any other place. Mm-hmm. And I think what tends to happen is the moment that you begin to say, hey, you know what? Maybe I agree with him about this thing right here. But this other thing over here, we're not going to accept this. This is not going to be tolerable. But there had such a tendency to from both camps. It wasn't just, you know, I'm speaking from my perspective, but I saw it on both sides in mm-hmm. abundance, that you would ignore the very glaring problems on this hand because you viewed the problems on the other side of the fence to be more paramount and to be, well, that's evil. So, you know, this person's not perfect, but this is evil. And what they would do is, again, they would homogenize the individual instead of looking at it in a more sort of nuanced and complicated way, to the degree that I would have felt very refreshed if people would have said, hey, regardless of how this all plays out, we just want to let you know this is not representative of what we're supportive. This over here does not reflect, you know, how we feel. And people were not largely willing to do that except in private conversations mm-hmm. or perhaps in more, you know, more communal areas where there was a little bit more safety. Publicly, there was a line in the sand, and you were either on this side of it or you were on the other side of it. And that is a dangerous place to position your friends, your family members. It's dangerous to begin to see people as this other thing, that as if the only reason you could vote for this person is if you are, you know, for killing babies, or if you're for, you know, all of these scandals, mm-hmm. and the only reason that you would vote for this other person is because you're a racist and a bigot. And it's not that simple. It has never, ever been that simple. And if this story illustrates anything to me on a personal level, it's that fact that you cannot look to the other side of whatever proverbial fence you're on and homogenize them as this one big sweeping thing, because people are complicated and they care about complicated things. And it would be better to us to raise the level of conversation to where we understood that complication and addressed that complication as what it is, rather than try to say like, oh, nope, just, you know, write this off. You guys with your objections, you shut up and stop whining. And you guys over here with your praise, you're just racists and bigots. And it's not that simple. And it will never be that simple. And the end of lecture.
Well, and I think that's the good part, because that's step one in us taking the small story and kind of starting to throw stones at the larger theme of this thing, is how one of the most quoted lines of A Monster Calls is humans are complicated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually had that quote right up in front of me because it's just, I think the full line is humans are complicated. They believe comforting lies while knowing full well the truths that make them necessary. And we see this in our everyday lives, you know.
Absolutely.
It could be, you know, I could quit fill in the blank anytime I like, or, you know, abortion doesn't hurt anyone. You know, you just hear this stuff on a daily basis, mm-hmm. especially on social media.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's easy for us to see it on the macro level, and it's one of those things that's hard for us to apply on the micro level. Because Reed, I like the way you laid that out, and but like when you take what Scott just pointed out, how we can kind of internalize these are things that affect me every day. These are little lies I tell myself to do anything that I want, because mm-hmm. while I, you know, this is Paul saying that he wants to do the right thing, but he always finds himself doing the things that he doesn't want to do. You know,
right.
No matter how good of a husband I try to be, I always find a way to justify just a couple more minutes of that thing that I'm doing that's not helpful. Or, like, hey, I've got to go take out the trash, but while I'm out here, I'm just going to kind of meander, because I don't have to go back in and do a chore for a minute. Like, any little thing that I can to justify or ignore a truth, that a reality that I need to engage, is, like I said, that's the micro. And I think that's one of the hardest parts.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
So Scott, you gave us, a great story. One, we have story number two now, the parson and the apothecary. So Reed, can you kind of sum up the parson and the apothecary? And Scott, be ready,
because
you're going to have to address it.
So the Parson and the Apothecary story is basically the apothecary was he was a chemist who he made medicines for the entire town, and he honed in on a yew tree that was in the center of the town, and he wanted to chop down this yew tree and use its properties to make more medicines and chemicals that would heal people. But he was blocked by the parson, who was not only, you know, adamantly against the apothecary in general, but adamantly would not let him chop this yew tree down. And so the apothecary grew very bitter, because the more the parson sort of decried him in the public eye, his business began to falter and fail, and so people weren't accepting his medicines anymore. So then eventually a huge sickness hit the land, and when that huge sickness hit the land, then the parson's daughters became sick. So he went to the apothecary and he said, "Hey, I'll give you the yew tree. I'll stop preaching against you. I will give you whatever you want if you will just heal my daughters." And the apothecary said that there was nothing he could do for him, and went in, and, you know, basically the parson's daughters died. And so then we later discover, when the monster went walking, he destroyed the wicked man's house, as it was, and then the twist in that story is that the wicked man was actually the parson and not the apothecary, even though our sentiments go, you know, sort of against the apothecary. And the monster in that story identified, hey, the apothecary was a greedy man, and he was, you know, he was sort of shrewd, but he was also a healer and did much good, whereas the parson was a man of belief, and he didn't have any, because the moment that his circumstances changed, his beliefs changed. So his beliefs were not substantive, and as a result, there was nothing, you know, belief in the healing power had to be present for it to work. So there was nothing that the apothecary could do for him. So it was an examination of motives and intentions, and an examination of just the inner workings of individuals versus the surface level of it. Was that a decent summary of that?
I guess it's okay. You know, I probably could have done a better job, but, you know, I wanted to get you guys involved a little bit, I guess.
Whatever. Of course you could.
It was quicker than mine. I'll give you that.
The lies that I tell myself. So Scott, how does this seemingly random story apply to Connor in his grieving process?
Well, you know, this was a story of a man that was punished for his selfishness. And after they tell this story, I believe this is the part in the movie or in the story where they go and wreck things, right? The monster. Yes. and the boy. Yeah. And, you know, the monster's telling, or Connor's telling the monster, you know, tear the whole building down, tear, you know, all this. And the monster was at his command. And then, you know, what the monster tells him at one point, it's like, all right, no, you do this now. So, you know, when he was destroying all of this stuff, he was actually destroying things in real life. It was his grandmother's room that was ended up getting destroyed. So there's a lot of stuff there. But before I get into that, I really want to talk about, because we haven't talked about this yet, every single story that is told is illustrated fantastically on the screen.
Oh yeah.
And the monster and the boy are actually, I guess, CGI'd into this illustration. And one thing I really wanted to point out was what the art was. It was watercolor. And for artists out there, or even if you're not an artist, you know what watercolor is. And it's a very messy medium, and the colors, when you're doing your paintings, they bleed and they blend together. There's no precise lines. There's no, everything just kind of blends together. And with Connor, when he starts destroying these things in at the end of the story and subsequently in real life, you know, our pain and suffering, it bleeds and blends with a lot of different things. And in the case of this story, you know, this is part of the healing process. So as, you know, he's destroying things in this, I'll call it a vision, I guess, in at the end of the story, that is, you know, bleeding into his real life, you know, what is going on you know, that is going to affect him directly, not just, you know, the experiences he's having with this monster. So I'll toss that to you guys. See what you guys think about that, how the I guess the art plays as much of a character into this as the stories do.
Yeah, I was going to say, Reed, what do you have to say about your own storytelling?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to think about just methods and mediums and think about how they – I myself am not as cognizant as I probably should be about the way stories are told and about the way certain communication happens. You know, they say that most of your communication is actually not verbal, that it's what your body language, it's your tone of voice, it's the things that people are picking up on, and they're registering elements that are not necessarily what you're saying, and oftentimes those elements are truer than what you're saying. And there's there can be an honesty present in your body that is not present in your words, and there can be you know, you can expand that. Again, I'm now talking on a micro level, but you can expand that very far out. The methods you use, not even just visually, but stories are communicated through music, through song. They're communicated through imagery without any sort of commentary, just a still image. And I think the way that a story is chosen to be told is as important as what story it's actually telling. And I think for myself, I'm not as cognizant as I should be. I want people to concentrate on my words, and I'm not as attentive as I should be in my personal life to how I'm using those words. And with the other elements that, you know, like that are at my disposal to communicate things in a variety of ways, even right down to whether or not I'm actually looking at the person as I'm talking to them, or whether or not I'm distracted or looking at something else. I'm not as cognizant of that as I should be.
So I do like the fact that, Scott, you brought up the medium in which it was done, because I remember sitting, you know, through the first story and then through the second story, and just being really blown away, being like, you know what? Like, I thought the monster looked really good, but I want to say that I should have been like broken up a little bit, or like taken out of the story when they changed to this animation style to tell these stories. But somehow it just flowed really nicely. So I think that's it is probably doing more for me connecting to the mini stories than even the words that the monster was telling. But I did notice that it still elicited like an emotional response, because in the second story, I am only thinking that the monster is going to destroy the Parsons' house because of the kind of bait and switch he pulled on the first story. And I was having a hard time kind of figuring out why. And I, having thought about it since then, I mean, it didn't take me that long. Sometime later in the movie, I was kind of mulling over it as well. But this idea that the parson, whose one job really is to encourage people to believe, had no faith himself.
Yeah.
And how that was somehow more atrocious than a healer not willing to heal, or letting two girls die. And I do think, I want to say, Reed, maybe you said it, that the first part, well, one of you guys said it, so one of you are really smart, who knows, that you know, what they pointed out, that like belief was kind of like the first step in healing. And that really stuck with me, and I think I'm still working that out. Like I feel like if your job is to believe and you don't, there's like an obvious, like, a piece of hypocrisy. There we go. English. There's a bit of hypocrisy there. And I really am trying to personally connect that to Connor's story. Like, where does Connor fit in this story? Do you guys have any specific thoughts when it comes to the belief part?
In the context of the second story?
Yeah, in the context of the second story, because I think the thing is, Connor actually believes that his mom's getting well, or maybe it's that she doesn't, or maybe he really doesn't.
I apologize for cutting you off, but I think it's that he really doesn't. And I think that it's made apparent by the nightmare that he's been haunted by, by the fact that, you know, when he finally tells his story, I think that it's apparent that he recognizes that this situation is dire, but there can be this tremendous need, this tremendous pressure to cope. And I think this is specifically in the faith community. There can be a tremendous pressure to cope and to believe. We have this this strange stigma. I recently saw, it's ironic that we're talking about this, because I recently saw a movie called Gleason, which we're not talking about right now, but it was about a football player who suffers from ALS. There's a couple of scenes in that movie where his father is very impassioned about faith healing, and through the lens of like a Christian perspective, is like very adamant about you have to pray, you have to believe, no doubt, all this kind of thing. And it reminded me of that impulse that we all have. On one hand, you can say belief is a vital part of healing, but on the other hand, you could say that it all boils down to what you believe, and that it all boils down to whether or not you believe strongly enough. And I know a lot of people, when they suffer tragedies or when they suffer afflictions, whether they be in your physical body with sickness or through some other circumstantial thing, like, why did this bad thing happen to me? I'm such a strong believer, and I do all of these other things. And we can, it's funny, I keep coming back to this word, that we make it all or nothing, to where we homogenize even our own belief systems, to where it's like, oh no, my belief will accomplish anything. It will accomplish anything without help. And that's all that I have to do, is I just have to believe. And then the opposite side of that fence is the one where it's like, well, belief doesn't really matter. It's a dice roll. Either this is going to work or it's not going to work. And I think that the proper whole way to look at that is a marriage of those two and a balance of those two, that you have to have faith, but you have to also understand and trust that you're not, that your faith does not give you control over the situation. It does not give you the ability to manipulate whether or not something is whole. And I think Connor was resisting admitting that he didn't believe his mom was going to get better, because if he ever voiced that, if he ever verbalized that, then she wouldn't get better and he'd feel guilty and blame himself. And maybe somewhere down deep inside of him, that's part of what's really troubling him, is he's like, oh man, I don't believe my mom's going to get better. Is that why she's not getting better? And, you know, the film doesn't lay all of that bare, but I think that's part of what's going on with him, specifically why he keeps wanting to get punished and why he keeps acting out. Like, somebody punish me for thinking these things, and somebody punish me for making this all worse. And that's not the reality of the situation, but he's haunted by that feeling. And I think that's what the monster's tapping into in that second story, if that all makes sense.
No, it does. And I think it leads really well into the third story as well. Because in the third story, you know, we don't get one of these kind of cool animation things or these great mediums that we've already seen. But the monster basically tells a very, very quick story that says there was a man who was invisible because no one ever saw him. Tired of this, he summoned the monster to ensure no one forgot to see him again. The monster made them see, but there are harder things than being invisible. And of course, like, when this story is being told, Connor is basically like, you know, embodies the monster and physically beats this bully that's been picking on him and puts him in the hospital. So,
yeah.
So Scott, I'd love to get your kind of perspective on this. Like, when the monster says there are harder things than being invisible, I mean, I don't want to say what does that mean, but kind of what does that mean? I mean,
maybe it means just dealing with it, dealing with your feelings, being true to yourself. And I know that's going to come up later when Connor, you know, tells his truth. But I don't know. Like, I would just, you know, at that scene when he like embodies the monster, he is being true to himself in a very physical way, but he's letting out all of his frustrations, everything onto this onto this poor sap of a kid, you know, who has, you know, really kind of berated him, and like throughout the whole movie he's kind of being bullied by this kid, and you know, it's this scene where, you know, you see it happen in this glorious shot of the monster behind him when he's running down the cafeteria, you know, charging at this guy, and it's awesome. But at the same time, it's like, oh man, no, this is not the way you deal with your problems, Connor. Yeah, right, but right. Yeah, it I really want to bring up something, and I think this has to deal with this final story in a sense. But when I went to go see this movie, I think I mentioned this on Facebook. When I went to go see this movie and I bought my ticket, the box office attendant told me that I was the only one that had bought it for that showtime. And I made a joke to him. That was like, it was in the morning. It was like a morning matinee. And I made a joke to him. It's like, oh, I guess no one wants to be sad this morning. You know, he chuckled, I chuckled, we had a good time. But it was a joke then. But then after, you know, waiting a bit, you know, around the area, I was waiting for someone else to come that I was seeing it with, all the families and seniors too, I was listening, you know, what all they were going in to go see, and it was Sing. And I was like, okay, there's something here. You know, I'm the only one that's seen A Monster Calls and everyone else is seeing Sing. You know, and I thought about it a while after seeing the movie. And, you know, I don't want to get down on a movie like Sing. You know, it's a pick-me-up. You know, I think I said only as a pick-me-up bubblegum piece. And I think there's a time and place for those. There's nothing wrong with seeing that. But for people that, I guess, don't want to go see a movie like A Monster Calls simply because they hear it's a sad story or a darker story, I think there's something deeply embedded in that. A Monster Calls, it really breaks through this stigma that our culture has placed around death and how we react to it. Nobody likes to talk about death. Okay. We really suppress that. And especially I'll go even far to say this, especially in Christian circles. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, it not only happens to all of us, but it happens around us on a regular basis. All you got to do is go online to a news site and you hear about a bombing somewhere, or, you know, some celebrity has died and everyone's sad about that, or, you know, but I notice that nowadays, you know, even our churches and our religious communities, they really skirt around this topic. And, you know, we don't even call funerals anymore. We call them celebration of life. We don't say that someone has died. We say that someone has passed away. You know, and you know, passed away, that's a very, in my opinion, kind of pagan way of saying it. You know, when we die here, we die. We leave this body, we leave this earth, and we go somewhere else. We're not like, you know, this vague passing away into, you know, fill in the blank here. It's like, no, we're dead. And it's that, I guess, finality that, you know, I don't know. It's that we just don't want to talk about it. And Connor, you know, he definitely wanted, he was denying that to himself about his mother. You know, he did not want to think that, you know, he knew in the back of his mind, you know, there's like, yeah, these treatments are not working, but he did not want to, you know, really believe the fact that, you know, his mother was not going to be there much longer. And of course this leads into his story. So, yeah.
I have one quick little thought on that, and I'm going to, as I usually do when I come on to Real World Theology, I'm going to apologize again for a statement that I'm about to make. But
love it.
But, get your seatbelts again.
but this one's more in the theological realm. The fact, Scott, I think you're absolutely right in that we don't know really how to deal with the problem of death, even especially in faith circles. And I think for the Christian believer, I'll be very specific to that subset of humanity, to the Christian believer, it is the direct confrontation with the curse. Like there would be no death if there were no curse of sin that we acknowledge is what's ultimately and fundamentally wrong with everything. Every subdivision of every problem that we see roots back to the problem of sin. And that problem of sin is the curse of death. that is plaguing everything we see around us. So we have a hard time dealing with that. And I think on a psychological level, now stepping back from the theology, I think on a psychological level, when we believe in Jesus Christ, we have some severe difficulty accepting that we still have to face the problem of the curse, that we still have to face the issue of dealing with death. Because even and so it's this juxtaposition inside almost every believer's heart that you have to recognize that we're still going to deal with this until such time as we believe to varying degrees, until such time as Jesus says enough's enough and everybody out of the pool, you know, that like until we reach that day, we are going to have to deal with this. So when an elderly person gets very sick, or when someone gets sick abnormally young, or when something happens that is just your body betrays you, or things begin to happen that, oh, this is not supposed to happen to a believer, or this is not supposed to happen to, you know, to somebody who is faithful. And one of the things that it makes me think about, and I've wrestled a lot with the notion of when Jesus would heal someone, and then a couple of times he would say, you're going to do greater things. To his disciples, you're going to do greater things than you see me doing. And I have wrestled and thought with that idea so many times, because I don't know what your guys' specific denominational background is, but mine was Pentecostal. And so there's a lot in my sort of cultural upbringing of name it, claim it, you know, laying on of hands, the sort of the prayer services, that kind of thing. And there was a lot of this conversation about the power of belief and sort of building up powers of belief to accomplish certain things in other people's lives. And one of the things that I've thought a lot in connecting the passage of scripture I just referenced back to A Monster Calls and hopefully threading it all together in a cohesive way is when Jesus looked at his disciples and said, you're going to do even greater things than this. And I think about people who suffer with a disability and yet still accomplish great things, and still, you know, even though their body may be incapacitated, maybe they are working hard for activism or for awareness, or maybe they're pressing through and still giving of themselves or giving of their time, and then other instances where maybe someone did die and maybe something really wrong happened that is unfortunate and is sad and is tragic, yet through that they pushed through that to accomplish something else. And it makes me think about how we believe that Christ's strength is made perfect in weakness, and that we don't want to accept weakness. We don't want to accept the ramifications of this curse that we believe we're all living under, because once we come face to face with that, we have to recognize that maybe part of the story is that we have to suffer a little bit in order to do these greater things that are set before us. And maybe Connor, if he's really going to be whole, has to face the fact that his mom is going to have to die, and that if he's going to really reach a place to where he's at peace with himself and at peace with the world around him, he's going to have to let her go. And that's something that is tremendously difficult for him to face, because it's all of these conflicting perspectives literally colliding in one place. The moment that tears me up every single time I think about it, and it was the first time I saw the movie, it was the first time I began to cry, is because when Connor gets so mad at the monster and he says, you're supposed to heal, you came here, you're supposed to heal, what are you doing here, you're supposed to heal, and the monster's walking away from him, but he just turns his head back and he says, and so I shall. And of course, I had read the book, but it connected with me, like, he didn't come to heal mom, like he didn't come to fix the mom, he didn't come to solve the problem. He came to help you make it through the problem. And so many times we want God to just show up and just fix the curse, solve the problem, make it all go away. And sometimes actually what the greater things than just solving the problem or healing the sickness or fixing the issue, sometimes the greater thing is this sickness, this issue will not be the final verdict. It won't have the power over you. You'll still be able to do great things. You'll still be able to move forward in it. You'll still be able, despite the fact of its reality, you'll still be able to accomplish something through it. That's kind of what all of that, hopefully that was cohesive, but that's what it all makes me sort of think about when I think about that, those ideas.
No, I think
that was really good.
Yeah. I would say that's basically, without stopping to preface Connor's story, I think we're already there. You know, he wishes that his mom would just, like, in his mind, would die sometimes so he would stop being in pain. And he points out exactly what you're saying, that as humans, we do not like pain. We don't understand why God can't come in with his magic wand and make everything good and happy. And, right. And I would say that if I've learned anything in my time on this earth, is that God can almost speak more clearly through grief than through, you know, happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because there's that message that I think is very important. And actually, I kind of get why it's so hard for someone who doesn't have a faith or a religion, especially I would say the Christian religion, that sees a world or has a worldview that doesn't have hope sitting at the end of the story. You know, yeah. Like I would feel really guilty if I was Connor and I didn't think my mom was going to go to a better place. Like I didn't think she was going to get like her, you know, super perfection body and like live in the radiance of Christ forever and ever and ever. Like if I thought she right. was just going to stop existing, I would feel awful because I wouldn't want my mom yeah. to just stop existing. But I actually find that it's not really that selfish at all to have that hope that the pain will cease. And you know, I don't want to dismiss, because I agree with Scott, what you were saying earlier about how often like there's this language that we employ, especially as Christians, to try to soften the blow. But you know, I do like the idea of having a celebration of life. I don't like to do it when we're pretending that there's not pain. Because it does suck.
That's
it
good
does,
clarification.
Yeah, yeah, it does suck. It does hurt. But at the same time, you know, like if you have like a grandmother or, you know, an elderly relative, who's suffering with like a terminal disease or like Alzheimer's, I've fortunately never had to really go through that. But like the stories that people who have like parents or grandparents who have Alzheimer's, like it's like one of the hardest, like they say, it's one of the hardest things to try to love someone who has no idea who you are. That has meant so much to you, and knowing that like a disease or infirmity or like some kind of crippling of physical nature has turned a person who was normally vibrant and full of life into like a bed-stricken, you know, unable to really communicate type person. Like it's almost, there is a joy knowing that they're going to go and be in a place where their body is resurrected. You know, mm-hmm. it's made glorious. And like I said, I would totally feel selfish. Not that I still want people to die just anytime bad things happen. You know, this isn't my, my sideways into euthanasia or anything like that, but, you know,
I should hope not,
but I do. Yeah. But I do think the, you know, having a, what is it? Tim Keller says, a worldview with windows that look out onto eternity, like that we can, let pain and loss actually be a joyous, thing. Reed, your story reminded me so much. I meant to look this up before the show so I wouldn't butcher it, but, it reminds me of that, the most used sermon illustration that I've ever heard, where Aslan's taking the dragon's skin off.
Oh, yes, yes.
And you know, he's scared because he doesn't want, you know, he knows it's going to hurt. He knows it's going to burn. But he says that, you know, Aslan is not safe, but he's good.
Right, right.
And, yeah. You know, and that's every single time I think about how I'm suffering in any given moment, whether it be like some long arc of pain that's going on in my life, or whether I'm sitting with like a grieving friend and have no idea what to tell them, which, you know, usually is don't say anything.
Right.
Just more hugs. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, when my wife is sad, or when I'm really disappointed in something and I'm like, where are you, God? Why am I hurting? And, it's comforting to me. And I hope other people to know that he isn't safe. There is no, like, I know atheists love to do that thing where they say, well, if God is good and why would he let bad things happen and stuff like that? But, that's safe. That's not good.
Mm.
And I feel like I need to have a read-size apology for grandstanding.
No. I think it's important and imperative that we remember that if we are going to, follow after Christ, we want to follow after the hey, I'm going to lay hands on the sick and they recover. I'm going to follow after the, hey, I'm going to speak this truth and, you know, I'm going to speak to the mountain and it's going to move. And we want to, and I'm not dismissing those elements because I deeply believe in those elements and mm-hmm. I have convictions that relate to those elements. But we must not forget that at least once Jesus asked, is it possible for there to be any other way? And there wasn't. Now we can debate the theological language of whether or not that was an answer to a prayer or not. I don't think that's terribly value. I think that the point is that, you know, is there another way that we can do this? No, there's not. And I think sometimes that is true for us. That I think sometimes is there another way that we can go through this? And we would love to, of course we can come up with them. Of course, we'll just do this and this will be easier and this will feel better, you know, but we don't even see every element of ourselves, whether we want to admit it or not. The most self-aware among us still don't see and have not mapped the entire interior landscape that we have in our heart. And the Lord does, and he does see all of that. So even when we're like, man, I would have preferred this. I would have liked this so much better. And the Lord, you know, again, being more good than he is safe, would look at us and would recognize like that's not true. And I'm fully convinced to my bone marrow that the Lord cares far more about actually doing good for us than he does about meeting our expectations mm-hmm. or about falling in line with what we would like to see happen, that he much more cares about saving us than he does about pleasing us. Yeah. And I don't say that to mean that he doesn't want us to feel delighted, that he doesn't want us to give us the desires of our heart. Again, I believe those things. I just think that we have to have space in our theological understanding to recognize that sometimes princes who are murderers get away with it, and sometimes witches need saving, and all of the things that the monster says. And I think that it's, you know, there were a ton of parallels in this story to what I see the role of God as in so many lives, that he comes in and he's kind of an iconoclast to many ways, that it's like, I didn't expect this to go this way. I didn't expect it to be like this. But then in the furtherance of time, you look back and you say, oh man, but I can see where he was at work in this. And I can see how, you know, this led to this understanding and this led to this revelation. And, you know, God just cares much more about actually bringing us home than he does about how pleasant the journey is for us to get there. And I know I might get some kickback on that idea, but I deeply believe it.
No, yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Oh, I completely agree with that. You know, I was so happy that A Monster Calls, you know, in my tears at the end of the movie, I was so happy that it was not a happily ever after story. And I was so relieved to see that it wasn't. You know, we have so many biblical stories of salvation and redemption, and they're not necessarily happily ever after stories. You know, the disciples were, you know, well, we know what happened to them, you know, tortured and persecuted and, you know, put to death. And, you know, in our moments of extreme suffering, it is hard to know if, you know, or even comprehend if there's going to be a happily ever after. But knowing the truth of the gospel, the truth of our of God's word. You know, this movie dealt a lot with truth. There's one quote in this movie that just was so strong to me. It's the stories are important. They could be more important than anything if they carry the truth. And I think it continues on to say, if you speak the truth, you'll be able to face whatever comes. So knowing that we have, you know, the truth, what Christianity, what, you know, reality tells us, you know, Christianity is the story of reality. It's how things are. And just knowing that, you know, there is hope, there is life after this one. That is a very, very powerful truth to carry, and one that we need to share with others.
Mm. Yep. I think that's spot on. I almost hesitate to say this because I think I may have mentioned it on a previous episode, but especially when we talk about like God's desire for us, I reflect upon that conversation that I had with a friend who asked me if God didn't want us to be happy. Or he said, you know, kind of rhetorically, God does want us to be happy though, right? And I said, it's not that God, kind of like you're saying, Reed, it's not that God doesn't desire for us to be pleased or anything like that, but in God's hierarchy of our needs, like happiness isn't at the top. Our being pleased isn't at the top. I would say all too often we trade in comfort and joy for happiness. Contentment and joy for comfort and happiness.
Mm. It's the whole your best life now.
Yeah.
Deal.
You know. Yeah. Mm. And mm-hmm. you know, when you talk about Bible stories that don't end well, Scott, it's really easy to kind of basically do what you're talking about right after, you know, what we go right out of the Bible and then we go into the early church, and there's very few people in the early church who aren't being martyred or killed or marginalized for what they believe, and they still manage to keep their joy and their contentment in something, in a truth that is bigger than their personal truth or, you know, the how they see the world at any given time, because they're comforted by this larger truth that transcends all this. Kind of like we see the monster eventually come in and kind of lay it out. He's like, I know this is what you believe, but I'm going to bring you something greater. And do it in a compassionate way, even if I'm forcing you to confront sadness and stuff. I say that needing to wind us down. I know we are running out of time for some of our guests, so I wanted to give one last chance for our guests to kind of have some final thoughts. So, Scott, is there anything else that you wanted to say about this film before we wrap up and send it home?
Well, to go along with what I said about sharing, you know, the greatest story of all, that truth. I also really wanted to emphasize something that I forget if it was said in the movie, but I just read it in the book. This very powerful line: don't think you haven't lived long enough to have a story to tell. Mm. Because your story can be just as powerful to someone else. You know, your truth, not in a relativistic way, but just what is, you know, what is personal to you can have a great impact on someone else.
That's great. Because, you know, that's one of those things. Oftentimes you hear people say, like, I was able to connect with someone because I went through this thing. And while I would never be as reductionist to say the only reason bad things happen to us is so we can talk to other people who have bad things that happen, it is a connecting point. Like, we do have stories to tell. We all have had something. So, Reed, I would ask you the same thing. Anything else that you want to leave people with from this film?
I would, as briefly as I can, just point out I do not believe that truth is relative or that it has degrees. I think if something is true, it is true. But we oftentimes don't recognize that sometimes seeming opposite things can also be true. And I think this film brilliantly illustrates that when Connor's first truth when he tells his story, is basically, I want it to be over. Like, I want this to be done. Mm-hmm. But the, okay, I'm sorry. I'm about to get, a little choked up. The
Mikey was supposed to get choked up.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. And it was my, but then, you know, he says, you know, I want it to be over. And that sort of, you know, he barrels through that. But then the monster is with him in the final moments. And he says, what am I supposed to say? Connor says, what am I supposed to say? And the monster says, the truest thing of all, like the baseline truth thing. And what he says to his mom is, I don't want you to go, you know, like, mm-hmm. and we have a hard time understanding that sometimes they can both be true. And if there's anybody out there who's dealing with some sort of like grief or pain or a hard situation, I just want to hopefully speak a word of encouragement that you can be honest about things that seem to be opposites, and both can be honest for where you are, that you can have a part of you that is just desperate for the problem to be solved and for the thing to be over, but then another part of you that is just desperate to say, I don't want it to go this way. Like, I want it to just be done with, but I don't want it to go this way. And we often will deny one of those things for the sake of the other one. And I think we do so at our peril when we do that, because we need to, and God's comfortable with the mess. God's comfortable with that sort of nuance. God's a God of justice, and he's a God of mercy. God is full of these things that we seem to see in conflict with one another, and yet the Lord brings them and somehow redeems them, just as he redeems God with sinners. And I think that's something that we need to be comfortable, if not comfortable, at least honest about the fact that sometimes there's this fact that is sitting here that says, hey, I just want this to be done. And then there's another fact that we have to break through that first one to get to the bottom one that says, hey, ultimately, I'm just going to miss you. And I think that it's possible for opposites to be true. And that's just what I wanted to hopefully remind people with and speak a word of comfort, that it's okay if it's confusing, and it's okay if it's messy, because more than one thing can be true at the same time, depending on what it is you're going through and what it is you're experiencing, and be honest about all of it.
And so I think we could probably safely refer to that as alternative facts, right?
Oh, there it is. There
you
it
had
is.
To go. You had to do it.
Listeners are putting down their Kleenex, and they're now picking up their Facebook to completely, you know, throw
here
away
come the pitchforks and yeah. the torches. And the,
oh, well, if you have pitchforks and torches, I want to let you know. I want to help you, the listener, find out where you can send those pitchforks and torches to. So, Scott, how can people find the work that you do on the web?
Well, I'm mainly on Facebook right now, for better or worse. I'm trying to converse as much as I can in the Real World Theology group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter as well, SCOKE15. I'm not even going to try to pronounce it for you. Just spell it out. I'm on Twitter. Hopefully, get my own podcast going fairly soon. So I'll leave details vague on that. But
Cool. I'll make sure any of those things I have linked in the show notes. Also, any way to get a hold of Reed, how would that be?
There's a few ways. I have my own show with co-host Nathan Rouse. That's The Fear of God, where we look at horror and Christianity and that intersection. So you can reach out to, you know, find The Fear of God. I'm also a recurring co-host on More Than One Lesson, morethanonelesson.com, which is also where The Fear of God posts hit. You could find me on Twitter at Reed Lackey. Our show Twitter is at The Fear of God. You could also email us to that fearofgodpodcast@gmail.com. And like so many great people, I am also frequently bouncing into the Real World Theology group. So those are a couple of places that you could sort of pop in and perhaps grab a connection to me if you wanted to.
Nice. So again, I will make sure that all those contact ways, methods, means, avenues, roads, are in the show notes that you can find at realworldtheology.com, which you'll also find a way to connect with me at Fizzification on Twitter. And as both these guys have mentioned, the absolute best way to continue this conversation is to hop over to Facebook and join the Real World Theology discussion group, where lots of us, almost anyone who's ever been a part of the show, is there conversating about movies and just talking about things that we don't have time on the show. Because as we were kind of reminiscing about before the show, there's no way we were going to hit everything in a movie like this. So I'm sure we'll have some discussion post haste. So as always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've not enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed it, leave us a 5-star review. If you've not, thanks for subscribing. 5-star reviews really help people find our podcast and get more people involved in the conversation. So I would really appreciate you doing that. And for now, for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
So I'm going to make a little mark real quick, and people will never know that that happened.
Let me go back in my, okay, well, I shouldn't have said that. Yeah, well, shouldn't have said that. Oh, okay.